I forget what the number is, but it's a very low number. Whereas a Stirling engine running on the thermal energy gets more like a 25% efficiency. That's the good news, but the Stirling engine's got a lot of rotary moving parts, which in theory can fail.
Repeater, time out.
They stopped that project.
I've read some articles on YouTube that lead you to believe that maybe they're going to start up the Stirling engine again. Let's see what Paul's got to say, because he's real familiar with all this. WS2N, tell us about the plutonium-238 and Stirling engines. You got it, Paul. KQRI, up in the second.
I was going to bring up the advanced Stirling engine, the advanced Stirling radioisotope generator. They call them ASRGs. They're still developing it. In fact, they wanted to use it for the Mars mission that was delayed. It was supposed to go up in 2016. What was InSight? It's not a rover, it's just a land and dig into the surface of Mars. And I was supposed to have one of these Stirling setups on it. But the timing of it, they weren't ready for it, so they made it solar panels. But ironically, that mission was delayed for 2 years because of another problem. So that's going to go up in 2018, but that's still going to go up solar panels. But the development is still under development with NASA at Glenn's Research Center. They're still working on it. They think they might have a possibility of having one of these Stirling setups in 2028, so still a ways down the road. You still need to make the plutonium-238, so you can't change it. You know, you still need that. And it's a 4-to-1 ratio. That's why they like Stirling things better. Let me drop it. They like the Stirling better once they get them working, because 4-to-1, you get much more power out of it compared to the RTGs. That'll be a lot better. So once they get something developed, you'll have either 4 times the output for a spacecraft, or you'll be able to have, you know, 4 spacecraft instead of 1. So we'll see how it goes. It's different. You take the heat, the actual heat from the source itself, plutonium-238, and use that heat instead of taking the neutrons, which are flying off of this thing and hitting a blanket, a carbon-based type of blanket, which actually then that gets hot, and then that's where they have the two different metals that are hooked up in parallel in series. That's the RTG, but this is they're gonna just use the heat instead of the fission, neutrons hitting the blanket, which normally gets very hot. Back to you.
Yeah, the two different metals you're talking about, probably thermocouples. Eric, I got two questions for you, which are right in your area of, I believe, expertise. Is there very much of a difference between a Peltier device and a thermocouple? Each one will convert electricity to temperature difference, or temperature difference into electricity. That's question number one. And when it comes to using solar cells to power your spacecraft, out at Mars where you get half the amount of sunlight, okay. By the time you get to Jupiter, I think you're down to like a 5 or 10% of the amount of sunlight. By the time you get to Saturn, I think you're down to 1%. So running solar power out of Saturn would be extremely difficult. You'd need an acre of solar cells to get the sleep power, if you know what I mean. But somewhere I've seen a couple of articles that didn't tell why, but they said the absolute maximum efficiency you can ever get out of thermal voltaics is something like 31%. And there's a theoretical physical absolute maximum of something like 31% for solar voltaic cells, energy input versus electrical output. Any idea why that crazy low number, and why it can't be exceeded? KE2EJ, K2IW on the tech man.
K2IW, KE2EJ. Well, Peltier devices
It's basically a semiconductor, you know. I think it's a piece of N material, piece of B, P material, and moves the heat where the sink is in the middle. And I don't remember. I think there's a limit as to what the temperature difference between the hot and the cold side is. The difference in temperature is not an absolute temperature. Let me look this up. I'll tell you in a second. What was the other part of the question? I'm sorry.
You're absolutely right. It's a temperature difference that a Peltier makes. Therefore, when it comes to cryogenically cooling transistors for a low noise amplifier, they used to make a three-stage Peltier. It looked like a wedding cake. We had some big healthy Peltiers on the first layer of the cake and then a few more on the second layer and the third layer. Each one gave you a small amount of temperature difference. And by the time you got to the third layer, you didn't get down to liquid nitrogen temperatures, but you got close. But at least it was something that wasn't using up a consumable, so to speak. So Peltier versus thermocouple. Thermocouple, I wonder if it runs by a similar characteristic where a temperature difference gives you the electrical output. So there's a whole series of questions there. And why is a solar voltaic device never exceeding 31% efficiency of energy input versus electrical output? Why is there a stone wall at 31%? KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. You're really talking about the theoretical limit of moving electrons pushed by photons. I don't have the answer to your question. It's an interesting question, Joe. I'm not that familiar with it. The only thing that I was familiar with was the ITG that was going to be part of Project Moonray, and basically that was a thermocouple, so it would generate the juice by collecting the heat. Thermocouples work at very low temperatures, but they produce very little output. The more heat you have, the more motion they create, the more current they generate. Thermoelectric generators using Peltier-type devices, I believe, are the basis of the RTGs that they're using at the moment. So, if I remember, there's an effect. It's going to come to the feedback. Yeah, feedback. There's that effect, which is the conversion of the thermal energy into electrical energy. I think that's what they use for the decay of radioactive material to generate power. Control WK2 again.
Looks like we got some more research to be done here as to Peltier versus thermocoupled Seebeck effect and why an absolute limit of 31% on solar voltaic efficiency. We'll eventually find out some of these things. Nice to know where the limit is. And they're talking about 2 and 3 stage type photovoltaics, which have much higher efficiencies. I think if you and I bought some solar panels to mount on our house for solar voltaic, I think they run numbers like 8 and 10%. Is that true, Eric? Go ahead, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. When I first started playing with solar voltaics many years ago, it was running around 6%. I think they got them as high as 12, 13, 14%. They've got different formulations and method of manufacture that makes them more efficient. Still got a long way to go. I mean, you know, you only, what is it, 1.4 kilowatts per square meter of potential light energy at noon. So efficiency is not there where we'd like it to be, but it's getting better.
And don't knock that sunlight. 1,350, whatever it is, watts per square meter. That's a lot of energy. I've got an acre of property at high noon, 4 million watts of thermal, of solar energy is hitting my property. 1,300 watts per square meter. That adds up pretty damn fast. 4 million watts. If I could gather 1% of that, it would be 40 kilowatts. I wouldn't know what the hell to do with it all. So the Rohr energy is there. If you look at the total solar energy given to the Earth versus the total amount of energy that mankind uses, all 7.3 billion people, is a huge ratio. We got a long way to go. We don't have to build that Dyson sphere for a long time to come. Let's go over to that first mailbag here, John.
Give me one more thing.
Go ahead, Eric.
You know, when you go out into the Midwest where there are these solar farms, like if you ever go to Vegas, you can see what they have at the University of Las Vegas, Nevada. If you drive down the road there, you'll see this weird-looking thing with mirrors all over it. It actually has a distilling engine on it. The thing produces around 3,600 kilowatts at the height of day. It's, you know, light into mechanical energy. And there is quite a difference in terms of stopgap, where the big solar plants, which have all the mirrors that focus on the reaction plate, that uses a fluid as a medium, and it drives a traditional generator in a traditional fashion. Just wanted to throw that in. K2RIWK, John.
Yeah, that solar tower technique with all of those aimable mirrors, thousands of aimable mirrors, very elaborate-looking installation that you put in a desert area. If you compare the efficiency of that and the cost-to-benefit ratio, as opposed to the same number of solar voltaics running at, let's say, 15% efficiency. If you had the choice on your 1,000 acres of property, which would you choose, Eric? KE2EJ, KQRIW?
No, for a given square area, from what I understand, the conversion of heat energy at this point is still beating out the solar panels in terms of amount of area that you have to cover, because you're using these mirrors to create a focal point. You're creating this immense amount of heat energy. You can do that at a higher efficiency than you can with photovoltaic. But on the downside of that, you've got all this stuff that has to move as the Earth rotates. In order to keep the thing going at peak efficiency, plus you have all the mechanical things that you got to keep the mirrors moving. The photovoltaics make much better sense, even though you can get more power out of this more complicated stuff. K2RIW, K2J.
So some percentage of those movable mirrors probably have a downtime. It's an elaborate, expensive installation. So when it comes to dollars spent versus electrical power output, I think you and I would choose photovoltaics, because it's so much simpler. Even though the total number of kilowatts of electrical energy we get would be a bit less.
Oh, it has a downside too. You have to convert it.
Yeah, but the electrical converters these days are running awfully efficient, and there's no mechanics involved, if you know what I mean. Eric, go ahead.
No argument. But when you do get into high current, high power, and it's amazing some of the devices that we have today that handle, you know, not hundreds, but thousands of amps, they still have a failure rate.
And choose the size that has the lowest failure rate and put a whole bunch of them in parallel to get up to the number of thousands of amperes that you need.
Oh, I'll go solid state any day.
Now, I was describing what I thought was solid state, whereas these solar-powered towers, I think you're saying they're running on a fluid that goes into a turbine that's heating some other fluid that's boiling off. It sounds like a lot of mechanics involved, from moving the mirrors as well as taking the thermal energy, converting it to mechanical energy, and that in turn goes into an alternator that converts it to electrical energy. Awful lot of converting going on there.
Yes, there is, but per square mile, it's still more efficient. You know, what is it, California Edison, they've got a couple of those going, and they also have equivalent solar things going in the desert, which take up like 4 or 6 times the amount of square space that the mechanical systems do. I mean, you talk about mechanical systems, I mean, hey, plug into the wall right now, it's not coming from magic, it's coming from spinning wheels that are being driven by steam or water, you know?
That solar power tower, make a guess as to what overall efficiency of solar input versus electrical energy output. Do you think they're getting 40% out of that, Eric? Go ahead.
Don't quote me on this, but I remember the numbers are starting to get higher and higher. But again, I can look this stuff up. The last I remember was something like 48 or 49% at that point, and that's a couple of years back when I was interested in it.
So in a desert area like Arizona, that's great. A system like that on Long Island where we've got so darn much cloudy days.
Don't even try it.
A cloudy day probably takes the solar voltaic down to, what, one quarter or one eighth of its normal electrical power output? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, actually, it's, I think it's a square law in terms of output and number of photons. But the thing with the mirrors heating up, the reaction plates are heating up a carrier fluid. They don't work on cloudy days. They don't give you partial output, whereas the photovoltaics do. With the other system, you have to reach a minimum temperature in order to push the mechanics by.
So they didn't put enough spare thermal energy into it so that it can tolerate a cloudy day. But the good news is that Arizona probably gets, what, five cloudy days a year?
No, they put these things in deserts that don't ever see much rain, so that means you don't see too many clouds either.
And if you're a 10 gig operator, you like clouds because you can reflect your 10 gig signal off of a cloud very nicely, either to reflect it back or to reflect it forward. John, KC2WGB, please read your mailbag for us. You got it, John. K2LIW, the tech man.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Actually, Stephen, I believe it was Stephen, wrote that question in, and that was sent to me also, so that covered that first question. But I do have a second question, and it's from a youngster who would like to know how, if you know, how the optical mouse works. He seems to be mystified by that. Maybe you could say a few words on that. KC2WGB, back to you.
That's got to be Eric's area. KE2EJ, how does a mouse work? K2RW, optical mouse.
Did you ask me something, Dick?
Yeah. The question we got in the mailbag is, how does an optical mouse work? I presume he's really asking, when you steer it left and right and up and down, how does the mouse know what direction it has been moved when it moves across a piece of paper? Go ahead.
Right, the easiest way to understand it is to use the old-fashioned mouse that had the little rubber ball on it. And basically, the rubber ball sits against two rods. One is perpendicular to the other. So one rod senses left and right movement. The ball rubs against this rod. The rod, in turn, hits an optical encoder. And when you move the mouse up and down, the ball rotates in that direction. It moves the other rod, which is connected to another optical encoder. That's how you basically say where the mouse is once you've established that the mouse is somewhere. When you move it left and right, the one optical encoder will put out pulses. And when you move it up and down, another optical interrupter will put out pulses. Those are in turn serialized, and that's what the computer sees. So every time you move the mouse, it sends an address, literally, through the serial port of the mouse connected to the computer. That's the most simplistic way. Let me let it drop.
AC2IS info.
We'll pick up that other station in a second. Typically today, we don't use the ball anymore. We use LEDs that are polarized in two directions and little photo detectors. And it, in essence, does the same thing. I'll get back to you, Dick. K2RW, K2J.
Before we pick up Bill, I've got the obvious question, though, Eric. In the case of a shaft encoder, you've got real black and white bars that are leaking by, and the photocells can easily see which one came first, and Therefore, we can tell clockwise versus counterclockwise direction, if you know what I mean. There's real bars going by. In the case of a modern-day optical mouse, wiping across what looks like a clean piece of paper, there ain't no bars there. There's very little detail on that paper. So what in the world is your horizontal and vertically polarized light-emitting diodes and photodetectors? What are they seeing to know that you've moved the mouse over the paper? Over to you, Eric.
Okay. First of all, you're using polarized light for separation of direction, right? Now, the other thing is, you'll notice that the optical mouse does not work on certain kinds of surfaces. Okay? It needs to be able to detect minor differences in the surface. For example, if you use an optical mouse on a piece of glass that don't do its own thing, it has to reflect the light back to the photodetector. And that also has to have changes in polarization, the way that originating LED light, it's not actually laser light, hits the paper or whatever the surface is, and as you move it, the angle at which it deflects changes, and that in turn in the photodetector causes a voltage that's either increase or resistance, depending upon the device, to increase and decrease as you move it across there, and that's how it determines that it's moving. K2RIWK2JAX.
I can see how it would get too little reflection off of glass and it can't work. If I had an extremely smooth piece of very white paper, which is giving me lots of reflection, but unless I look with a microscope, I'm not going to see any detail to that white piece of paper. This is an experiment I haven't run, but if I got a very shiny piece of very white, very smooth paper with no markings on it, do you believe the mouse would still know when I'm moving up and down and left and right? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Yeah, actually I do. We're talking about photons here. So, we're talking about things that are kind of tiny, and there are certain kinds of surfaces like glass, where as light shines through it, assuming you're not getting it at first surface reflection, because it's a perfectly pure medium, that's where things don't work. But, you know, a really smooth piece of paper, if you look under look at it under the microscope, you'll see that it's not perfectly flat. And when photons hit that, they bounce off at different angles.
Then those light-emitting diodes and photodetectors must be extremely well-focused to see those fine details. And if I was doing that with that very smooth piece of paper and I picked up the mouse so that it's now a 16th of an inch higher off the paper, maybe it would stop working. Let's see if Bill can give us more information on this. AC2IS, how does that work, and how many of you disassembled, Bill, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, this is Bill, AC2IS. I have assembled, usually to clean, many an optomechanical mouse, but I believe the person was asking about optical mice, which, as far as I knew, did not use polarized light and did not really work anything like an optomechanical mouse. As I understand it, there's essentially a CCD or an array of optical diodes, I guess you'd call them. They're essentially sensors. And yes, as earlier, well, the very early optical mice worked on a specially made mouse mat that had reflective areas and areas that were painted black, so that the array, the sensors, they were not as high resolution and not using modern CCD cameras, very early ones, could see the transition from dark to light. And they had their sensors aligned horizontally and vertically, and they would watch these black dots go by on a reflective surface. I'm going to let it break for a second. As essentially cameras, imaging technology got cheaper, optical mice switched over to use using those types of sensors. So nowadays, and again, earlier versions of these mice would work very poorly, Dick, on a flat white sheet of paper. You'd need something with some kind of texture to it. And even nowadays, optical mice have switched over to using, I believe, laser diodes. But still, same kind of optical, you know, CCD kind of sensors, essentially cameras, and they're just able to pick out in a plain white, you know, your average plain white sheet of paper, you're able to pick out essentially the grain and the texture in that paper, and it's got essentially a little computer inside, a microcontroller, I believe, in 8051, going back in the day of, you know, early microcontrollers. I think all the mice are based on these, and it's looking to see the image scroll under the mouse, sees if it's scrolling up or down or left and right, and I believe does not send absolute coordinates to the computer, but sends information, hey, the, you know, the mouse moved this much. AC2IS.
Yeah, Christopher, my son, KB2IQN, has given me an optical mouse. I used to have a bowl-type mouse, which, of course, picks up dust periodically and has to be cleaned. And so the ball rolling left and right would turn one shaft and up and down turn the other shaft, and the shafts were essentially potentiometers, shaft encoders. My optical mouse, if I wave my finger in front of its optical detector, I will see the pointer move up and down, slightly jumpy. In other words, I think it's looking at the fingerprints as optical devices that move. And I've got a pad that it works with very well. I just went now and got a very clean piece of white paper and waved the mouse across the white piece of paper. And it sort of moved, but in jumps. It was not very reliable. So it does need some detail. So I guess whether that detail be the individual bars of a shaft encoder, let me drop it, or the microscopic details of a real piece of paper with a finely focused laser beam, light emitting diode beam. I'm a little bit curious, Eric, as to why they would use horizontal and vertical polarization. Why couldn't there be a detector for up and down and a detector for left and right, regardless of polarization? Or, when you're looking at the fine details of paper, maybe the polarization tends to have more contrast when it comes to those fine details moving. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I'm sorry, Dick. I keep stepping away.
You're on duty. Because the light-emitting diode type mouse has to detect up and down and left and right motion, why bother polarizing that light? In either case, the fine details are going to be moving up and down or left and right. Do you possibly get higher contrast of the fine details when it's polarized? And I just did an experiment with my mouse. If I choose an extremely clean white piece of paper, I get almost no motion of the mouse, if you know what I mean. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
NWS1.
Okay, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, as you know, the rougher the material, there's a certain point where it tracks perfectly. Polarization is just to be able to determine whether you're moving it up and down or left and right. The way the light reflects off of it. Also, you know, I'm not going to say until I'm perfectly clear about that, but I need to check my thinking before I go any further. So I'll get back to you. KE2EJ.
JS info.
Eric, you sound like a Republican. I want to make this point perfectly clear. Okay, we're going to go to Paul and Bill in that order. WS2N, K2RIW. Go ahead, Paul.
I don't know if you ever saw the book, The Way Things Work, if I got that, and they talk about the mouse in here as well, you know, with the white being passed onto the surface, and it's essentially using a digital camera, you know, like the other guy was, the other fellow was talking about, and that collects the light scattered from the surface and then sends the image to the computer. So, I mean, they're really talking about a CCD camera in today's newest mountain. It's a new book, anyway. Relatively new. They made an older edition, but this is the newest edition. Back to you.
Yeah, I think I've got a copy of that book. I've got to look that up. AC2IS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, just wanted to say, I think I did mention earlier, as far as I'm aware, there is no polarized light involved in an optical mouse, although there are different kinds of optical mice. There are LED-based ones, LED-illuminated ones, and ones that are illuminated with laser diodes. Occasionally some that are illuminated with multiple laser diodes, and some of these are actually able to pick up detail in glass. So if you have a high-end enough mouse, it will it'll work on that white sheet of paper. You know, if it is actually paper and, you know, not plastic, it's got some kind of fibers in it, it'll pick up the detail in. And somehow these things are able to pick up enough detail by bouncing multiple lasers off of glass. There's some buzzword associated with that. I believe it's called dark field sensors. So that's a, sort of a buzzword used on some of the mice that are able to work on glass. But again, if you get a, you know, your typical optical mouse, it's going to have these limitations on, you know, not being able to work on glass or not being able to work on, you know, a very uniform, you know, white piece of paper kind of surface. Hey, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. I've done a little research.
Wait for the beeps. And by the way, Bill, each time we turn it over to you, you don't wait for the beeps. You come very close to timing out. You got it, Eric.
Okay, the business about polarized was one of the first ones that they tried. That's why it stuck in my head. But the current one, a single LED and an array of photodiodes set up in a grid that will consense the X and Y motion. Actually, here it says the earliest optical mice worked on pre-printed mouse pad surfaces. So, essentially, it's like a camera looking at the paper.
Let me do a quick check. Both Bill, John, and Eric, how many of you guys are using an optical mouse versus a mechanical ball-type mouse? Which are you using, Bill? AC2IS, K2RIW?
This is Bill, AC2IS. At work, I'm using an optical mouse. I don't think too many people use optomechanical mice anymore. Because they have not been, as far as I'm aware, they have not been sold in a long time. At the moment, I'm using a laptop that has a touchpad, so no optics, no optomechanical. I'm not sure what the touch technology is based on. I'm assuming it's a capacitive touch type sensor. ACIS.
And Eric, which are you using?
Oh, it depends. Actually, I have one with a ball on it that I really could get rid of, but it's not a, a little used computer that monitors the transmitter system. But for the most part, I use optical mice. But I also do have some touchpads, so. You know, the touchpad in the Mac laptop, that's essentially an XY array. Little contacts, if you want to think about it. It's capacitive, but it's a matrix. And what it basically does is it takes the X and Y coordinate location and fits it out as a serial thing. C2IW, K2J.
On the TechNet, you're the closest thing we've got to a computer maven, Eric. So I'm going to ask you another question. You may have been seeing on the news lately, there's been quite a few computer hacking hostage situations. Any idea what we should be doing other than backing up everything? And by the way, the backing up, I think it's got to be done manually. If you got some kind of an automatic backup, I bet you they can get into that too. So what do we got to do to protect ourselves from these hostage guys? I have the impression that they're so skilled that no matter how good your password is, they can get by your password and start doing funny things to your computer. KE2EJ, what do you recommend? K2RIW in the TechNet?
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, the way these attacks occur, it has to come to you. The only way it's going to come to you is in your mailbox. So the first thing is, don't open something that you don't know who it's from. Just get rid of it. That's one thing. If you're really serious about keeping your data, you keep it on another drive. You back it up regularly. And some people like to actually have a whole drive ready, and they update it, and then disconnect it, and then update it every now and then. So that way, if they get caught, you basically throw the old stuff out and put the new one in, and you've got a computer that's X number of days behind. So it depends on how diligent you are. The other thing is that don't think that they're actually bypassing your password and getting into your machine. You're opening the door and saying, come on in. So having a good firewall is one thing. That way people can't attack your machine from the outside. But you're still opening the door to a piece of email, and what you do with it is how it all starts.
Okay, opening an email from somebody I don't recognize obviously is dangerous. However, if when I open it, is the text itself containing the malware, or do I then have to open an attachment? And that attachment, I'm guessing, has to have some number of given bits or bytes to it before it has enough stealth to be able to do this. So just opening it, is that giving me trouble, or do I have to do at least one more step? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
No, if you're really serious about your data, anything questionable, you get it off that machine, you put it on another machine, which is expendable, and then open it. There are forms of email where they've even put code inside the JPEG picture that actually finagles its way out into your machine. There's a lot of different ways it can happen. If you're getting something that's just plain text, okay, you have to know that it's just plain text. There's nothing that it's going to do. But, you know, if you get a Word document and it may have a macro or something embedded in it, there's a whole lot of different schemes that people exploit in terms of the mail system, but not only there, when you go to other websites where they exploit some of the weaknesses in the browser that you're using. A lot of different ways. It's not a simple thing. There's no simple answer. But there's a lot you can do to protect yourself. KTRIWK2J.
If I'm looking at the listing of the email, and I don't recognize the return address, I don't recognize the message, it doesn't sound like somebody I know, or even if it does sound like somebody I know, but it's got a funny return address, when I press the key V and I look at what its real return address is under Victor, that could give me a clue. Can I also get a clue when I look at the number of kbytes of size? If somebody is sending me a few sentences, maybe it's a 3 kilobyte message. And if I suddenly see something with 3 megabytes, I'm going to be awful suspicious. From your point of view, Eric, is there a minimum number of bytes required in order to create sufficiently stealthy malware? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, there's been instances where the dangerous thing is something like 20 or 30 bytes long, which is essentially a IP address to go and hook your machine up to and have it do its thing to you. Text is going to be small. But if you're getting a Word document or some other, an Excel sheet, it's not going to be that small. I mean, just a blank Word document is something like, one and a half megs or something like that. That's all the container. Same thing with Excel. So you know, sometimes it's nice to see, you know, a 23 kilobyte message because you know it's just text.
So if I see a 23 kilobyte message, can I assume that it's safe, or is there a way that they could even bugger up the indication of the bytes so that the bytes that I see are not the real bytes that are there? Over to you, Eric.
Oh, look, Dick, there's lots of different games in this. Intelligence. So I don't know if I really want to call them intelligent because of what they're doing, but, you know, there's some smart people out there that can do pretty nefarious things with just a little bit of data, exploiting the weaknesses of the browsers and the operating system. And it's a cat and mouse game between the mostly in the Microsoft world. Not to say that it doesn't exist in Linux, but that's pretty damn hard. And it doesn't really exist in Mac either. You really got to go out of your way to do something for a Mac like you do for Linux or Unix. But still, everybody's focus is on Windows, and they try, and as they learn each new weakness, they do another update and fix that. So, you know, it's a cat and mouse game in terms of that kind of stuff. It's RWK, too, John.
So we got to be careful. These guys that are doing this hostaging and encoding, encrypting people's hard drive, and saying we'll only de-encrypt it and allow you to use it again if you pay us this number of dollars with Bitcoin. How in the world is that Bitcoin becoming so anonymous and non-traceable? Now, when it comes to the message itself, do you believe there's a chance that our three-letter agencies will eventually find out who the bad guys are? Give me a couple of words on this Bitcoin, which I'm pretty light on that one, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Well, K2RIW, KE2EJ, I'm not the expert in this, so I'm going to leave a lot of it out. I mean, I know some stuff, but I don't know if it's accurate or not. Bitcoin is as anonymous as a dollar bill is. A dollar bill has a serial number, which is traceable to a degree. Bitcoin is a little bit less traceable. But, you know, they almost went bust. When was it? A couple of years ago, there was some baloney that happened with them. They almost ceased to exist, but then all of a sudden, well, there's a history with that. But that's besides the point. We're talking about it being used not in a good way. So, you know, it's the criminal element of bullying people.
Okay, if you guys, somebody want to say something?
AC2WGB with a comment.
Go right ahead, John.
Couple things. If you want to make your computer secure, probably the first thing you need to do is check to make sure that your Windows machine is getting Windows updates. You do that by going to your Start button, Control Panel, and then checking Windows updates. Again, like I said, the first thing, the most basic thing, and most of the computers that are being compromised right now are sort of shockingly computers that have not had their Windows updates done. Some of these are big institutions, hospitals and so forth, are getting affected. The other thing with Bitcoin is that it was created to be quote-unquote pseudo-anonymous, which today's day and age means it's practically almost not anonymous at all. All the transactions are recorded in a public ledger. Anyone can read the contents of the ledger. And eventually, the idea is you're going to do business with somebody via Bitcoin if you're going to extract any value from it. And they're probably going to, you know, ship you something, unless you're buying, you know, illegal services. And then there'll be a ship-to address, and eventually the three-letter agencies will be able to track that down. ACQIS.
Comment. Yeah, the next person on the list was John. KC2WGB. Go ahead, John.
I think, I don't know if it's still true, but I was told that as long as you don't operate in the administrative mode, it has to ask you if you want to make these changes.
So that's one step I think everybody should have, and of course update Windows and your Norton, keep it all up to date, and you should have very few problems. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Since my system is a Debian Linux system, I'd like to believe I'm less vulnerable to this, but I could be naive. Wes, go ahead, you want to make a comment?
It's the same. I have a Linux system for cruising all around. There is a worry. The last virus that was acquired by thousands of people, it was based on a window that was open in the window system. That means there was a hole in the, so NSA, based on all of the available information, instead of notifying Microsoft, they start to use it, and they were using it to get into the computers of some of the fellows, till bad guys found that loophole, and they use it for themselves, and they stole the keys. So in other words, we may think of it as a police officer who has a gun. So by that, when police officer lose the gun and bad guy gets the gun, there is a police officer to be blamed for in the first place. You're not supposed to lose the gun. So that's what's happened with that weaponry. Now, as far as the information shared because of the updates, there is a program, a piece of software that is in the updates, and it's telemetry. So Windows 7 worked last, save Windows, but later on they find out that, well, we don't have a control over the guys who disabled the updates, and we're going to produce a few of the telemetry programs. We call them security updates, and whoever is less cautious is going to sit there and then report it. As for Windows 10 and Windows 8 users, especially 10, they have made it very tough that now you cannot even reboot your computer without doing update, because you don't have the button. It says update and reboot. So it doesn't give you that information. Now, whether the story is true or it's false, the rumors coming from supposedly very much knowledgeable people, every stroke on your keyboard is recorded and is sent somewhere to the servers. There's no more privacy. So, the difference between Windows 7 and Windows 10 is that in Windows 7, if you know which programs there are and it's easy to find on the internet, disable, not enable, disable all of the security updates. Unless you want to go crazy and read what are the new telemetry modules, and you do only the updates that serve your purpose. Other than that, one of the way of dealing with problems of security is never install any security updates at all. Keep it zero. Keep it fresh. I personally have a two operating system, Windows 7 that has nothing on it, and Windows 10 that I use because other programs require, especially editing program, require me to do have. But cruising is Linux. You don't have to pay any monthly fees, you say. And to adhere.
Info.
Go ahead, Bill.
I believe Wes was talking about a couple things there. One was, I think maybe he touched on, Windows 10 either was released without this particular set of vulnerabilities, or the fact that it aggressively performs updates meant that basically Windows 10 machines did not have this vulnerability that this particular bit of ransomware is going after. There was another thing where he said that the NSA had found vulnerabilities, and instead of notifying Microsoft, they started taking advantage of them, and I believe that's the case. But maybe one more detail there that the NSA built their own hacking tools to break into things, and at some point, the NSA or some part of the government was compromised, and those tools were discovered by hackers and then released to the world. So it's not just the vulnerabilities that other people discovered, but somebody came across the NSA hacking tools, and all of a sudden those became available to anyone who is interested in creating the latest bit of ransomware. There might have been one other thing I wanted to say, but it's slipping my mind right now. AC2IS.
Thank you, Bill. This has been on the news for the last couple of days, and I think we're going to be hearing more about it. And apparently, a particular young guy found a way of closing at least one of the doors to these vulnerabilities. I think we're late enough. We should go over to the space report. And so, Paul, I know that Elon Musk is proposing to put up thousands and thousands of satellites, and I'm having trouble believing he's going to get permission to do that, because it's going to really clutter up the sky. We're not going to be able to launch anything from the Earth anymore without striking some of these things, is one way of looking at it. WS2N, Space Report number 250, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
I got your email about that. And between them and Net One, I think it's called, they want to put up 900 satellites. Google wants to do it. And who knows how many other satellites that people are planning, the Iridium. It's just, you can't keep up with them. There's thousands of satellites that are actually up there, and maybe 1,500 or so that are probably operational. And most of them are probably dead, sent to the graveyard. This WS2N, I don't know if he's going to get final approval to do that, but he wants to manufacture his own satellites. Elon Musk and SpaceX, and then launch them. Launcher One is another rocket that's being developed by Virgin Galactic brand, and he's got a rocket that's going to send up individual satellites. Everybody wants a piece of that market. You've got the Electron rocket being built by Peter Beck in New Zealand, and he plans on doing the same thing, launching once a week a rocket with a small payload. And there's a couple more. There was one tested out just recently, about a week ago, called Vector. Vector Company is planning on doing the same thing, 100 kilogram satellites. And they'll be launched from Cape Canaveral. He wanted to launch from Cape Canaveral. I understand that he's going to get the clearance now to go to Camden, Georgia. But he might be able to launch from both places, as well as Kodiak Island up in Alaska for polar satellites. So, it's going to come to probably within a couple of years that I know I won't be able to keep up with them all. It's just as it is, it's a couple, probably 150 launches per year now, globally. That will probably change 3-4 times the amount inside of a couple of years. So we'll just try to focus on the what I consider the more important ones, and that's all we can do. There's a launch going up tomorrow. SpaceX again is launching from Cape Canaveral 39A, that same launch complex that all the
most of the Saturn rockets went up from, as well as most of the space shuttle launches that padded the turnover to SpaceX, and they rebuilt the whole thing, and they plan on eventually launching people from that launch pad within a couple of years. Once they rebuild their launch complex, Launch Complex 40, that was the one that blew up back in September. Then they'll have two launch complexes in Cape Canaveral in Florida to launch from, and they'll have another launch complex to land, Launch Complex 13, now called Landing Zone 1. So, and then I've done, yeah, they have Vandenberg Air Force Base. They took over Launch Complex there as well. Just to not to labor the point, but the SpaceX company is now going to be launching 5 satellites between now and the end of June, just the end of June. 4 from Launch Complex 39A and 1 from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Vandenberg will be another Intel. Iridium Next group. They're going to send up another 10 satellites in one launch. So, you know, every time they launch, Intel is sending up 10 at one time. So they did 10 a couple of months ago, and now they're 10 again. And then within the next year and a half, they'll do that 5 more times. So they'll have a total of 60 or 70 satellites orbiting the Earth. And like on that email I sent you, Dick, it's going to get to the point where I'm kidding around, but you won't be able to see the sun. Let me drop it. The International Space Station is up there. That's the biggest satellite going around every hour and a half. It's sending 1 million pounds of stuff around the Earth. And in fact, they did an EVA off of that with Friday. Peggy Whitson, American, and another American, Jack Fitch, did an EVA. They wanted to go out for about a little over six hours. They shortened it to around 4. They found a cooling leak in one of the umbilical lines, not in the spacesuit itself, but you know, where they put these spacesuits on. It's called the Quest Lab. There's a little leak in there, so they, that valve mixed up a little bit. They had to kill a little time looking into that. So they might eventually have to do another spacewalk to do some follow-up things that they weren't able to do. They did the main part of their mission successfully, and brought them back in because they went out late. And, you know, it has to do with the time the suit is actually operating. Because of that problem, they had to operate the suit on battery inside Quest Lab before they left. So instead of 6 hours, they shortened that down to 4 hours. This is WS2N. Last week we talked about the Mars helicopter. I found that story, Dick. They plan on putting a Mars helicopter on Mars. It's going to go up with the 2020 rover. So the Mars 2020 rover is, you know, think of Curiosity, powered by an RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. Same size as Curiosity. It's going to have more up-to-date equipment on board because, you know, the Curiosity landed in 2012. This thing's going to be landing 8 years later in 2020. But they plan on putting a Mars helicopter, they call it an MHS, Mars Helicopter Scout. It's going to have blades about 3 feet long. It's not a quad, it's like a helicopter. In fact, the base of it looks like a CubeSat, so it's about that big. So it'll be able to fly for you know, a minute or two, maybe go up to half a mile away from the lander. And, you know, it's a survey the area, see if there's any soft sand around, something that the you don't want the Mars rover to go into. So hopefully that will all come to pass. And how it's going to be powered, there's a solar panel on.